This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Winter Olympics start at the end of the week, and leading up to the International Games is a doping scandal. A group of Russian athletes were disqualified from the Games in South Korea for their participation in a state-sponsored doping scheme. But of course, that's not the first time doping headlines have cast a shadow over the Olympics or celebrated athletes, and not likely to be the last. Anthony Hackney is a professor of exercise physiology and nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, also author of the new book, Doping, Performance-Enhancing Drugs and Hormones in Sport. And he joins us now. Anthony, welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, it's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Tell us a little bit about this. You know, are there typical substances that athletes use to enhance their performance?
So there is a variety of doping substances, some of which we categorize as banned and some that are not banned. And the banning connotation is based upon anti-doping agencies in various nations and throughout the world that say, no, you can't use this because it's an unfair advantage. So there is a large variety of these. And I would say, you know, what people need to recognize is many of these actually work. There are some that are pure placebo. There are some that have no effect. But many of the, in particular, banned agencies, research supports that they work and enhance human performance. But having said that, there is the trade-off in that many of these ones that do work have some very serious health consequences and in some cases lead to premature death.
And you make the distinction in your book between two basic kinds of performance, right? Strength and speed and endurance, right?
Right. And most certainly we can get into the subtleties of, gee, where does soccer fit in with that or where would basketball? But from the perspective of human performance, we can look at strength and power related events, and we can look at endurance cardiovascular events. And from that, we see that many of the doping substances are tailored to improve one or the other.
Are these substances mostly made and designed for athletes? Because we know, I mean, for steroids, for instance, have therapeutic value. They get used all the time in other settings. So how many of these substances are really derived from therapeutic or other uses?
I would say the vast majority of the ones that you see that are on the banned list are really created pharmaceutically to help medical conditions. And what we find is unscrupulous coaches, trainers, athletes usurp those for some of their physiological benefits that would help different kinds of medical conditions in an attempt to try to enhance their performance.
So again, I mean, the question is, why do we ban these? Is it because we think it interferes with some concept of pure competition or because of the danger to the athletes? What's the rationale when they create a list like this?
So most certainly there is the ethical issue of, are we creating an unfair and unlevel playing field? But really, I think from a science point of view, the major concern is using these substances in the wrong fashion when you don't have a medical condition, using them at extremely high dosages, well beyond what we might normally pharmaceutically give someone, is really going to cause health problems that could be not only acutely a problem, gee, your blood pressure is elevated, but long term, you may develop liver disease, you may develop problems neurologically. So that is going to impact on the quality of life of that individual. And as I said, some of these you can very easily overdose with your exposure and die from usage.
Well, let's take the libertarian point of view. And I wonder if the argument has ever been proffered, which is to say, make them all legal. Then the playing field is level because everybody has access to them. Make sure everybody is well aware of the dangers and let the chips fall.
And there are people who have used that same logic to say that's exactly what we should do. But then we get into issues, who's not necessarily the best athlete, but who has the best chemist and pharmaceutical companies supporting them. We get into issues of, we still have to monitor. Are we going to say, let the chips fall where they may and you go ahead and die? Or are we going to say, yes, you can use this, but we have to make certain you use it only at levels that will not cause long-term health or premature death? So I think the real issue is, again, coming back to, are we harming the athlete? Is that the purpose of sport? I think not.
All right. And so, and again, when you get to performance enhancing, of course, every athlete wants to enhance their performance. Mm-hmm. So then where do we draw the line between, you know, if I eat me spinach, I'm going to be, my muscles will bulge. How much of that can I have? And is there some limit to how much kind of training or other kinds of health benefits I get from natural foods?
Well, I mentioned earlier the anti-doping agencies in countries. There is actually a umbrella organization. It's called the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. And nearly every country in the world belongs to WADA and has representation there. And each year, WADA creates a banned substance list. If something is on that banned list and you take it, we know that it's potentially helpful to your performance, but it is also so something that is going to potentially harm you. And if you're caught using it, then there's going to be consequences. If something is not on the banned list, then you're perfectly allowed to use it with no ramifications other than what you may find because you personally took a little too much. And an example I might give is caffeine. Caffeine's a nice stimulant to your nervous system. It has some very interesting properties towards regulating your energy metabolism. It's not a banned substance. You can take as much caffeine, perhaps, as you would like, but we all know if we have a little bit too much coffee in the context of the day, I can be a little hyper-excitable, a little bit too nervous. So there are, even on these non-banned substances, potential consequences from overconsumption.
Plus, you don't want to stop on the way on the 100-yard dash to use the restroom.
Usually does not help the performance
not
too
at all.
Much.
I'm talking with Anthony Hackney today. He's a professor of exercise physiology and the author of the new book, Doping, Performance-Enhancing Drugs and Hormones in Sport. And I'm doing that today on The State of Things. So let's talk about the ways in which I was going to talk about masking, but first, we talked about the fact that these drugs have therapeutic value in many cases. What if I have an ailment? I'm an athlete with an ailment, and I need this drug.
So in that particular case, the WADA organization, again, in concert with the national organizations, allows you to apply for what is called a therapeutic use exemption, a TUE as it's always referred to. And that means that you go to your physician says, yes, this particular substance is what I am prescribing to use to deal with your medical condition. The physician has to apply to the anti-doping agencies, document this history that you need this, why you need it, and in that case, it will be reviewed, and the anti-doping agency can say, yes, you are allowed to use this, or they are also allowed to say, we would prefer you use something else that's not on the banned substance list, or they might say, you can use it, but only at certain times. Because some doping substances, they're banned all the time. Some are banned only in competition. Some are banned only in certain sports.
Well, that leads to the question of testing. When do you test the athlete? And right. I suppose it depends on the substance.
Right. So the testing protocols that have been developed by the anti-doping agencies are really, really excellent. You know, I think they have protocols not only for how they're going to test in training, test at competitions, but then a chain of custody for the samples that are collected, and usually it's urine or blood, to ensure that the testing procedure really matches up with where the sample is from. And then there's really excellent recourses for the athlete to, if they have a suspected positive test, They don't like to immediately declare that this is a positive test. For the athlete to go through a procedure to be reevaluated and ultimately have legal recourse in the court of sports arbitration to plead their case on whether this was really a doping incident or I accidentally took a supplement that I did not realize was contaminated with a banned
or agent. May show up, may test positive, even if it doesn't have, which leads to the other question, masking. There's a bit of an arms race going on, right?
Yes. You know, one of the chapters in the book I talk about, we have doping substances, but then we have substances to hide doping. And these masking agents are quite prevalent. And the masking agent can be on a banned list or not, but if you're caught with a masking agent, I guarantee you, your samples will be further analyzed to determine why you have a masking agent in your specimen.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. If I can say, there's three things I want the non-scientists, if they take a look at this book, to come away with. These doping agents, substances, many of them work. Some are banned, some are not banned. The ones that are banned really do have serious health consequences that can result in premature death. And then finally, if you are tempted to dope, the anti-doping agencies have extremely good protocols and scientific methods for detecting it. You're going to get caught.
Anthony Hackney is a professor of exercise physiology and nutrition at UNC Chapel Hill and author of the new book, Doping, Performance-Enhancing Drugs and Hormones in Sport. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Just ahead, we'll continue our discussion about doping on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and continuing our conversation about doping. The Winter Olympics kick off this week in Pyeongchang. A lot of anticipation over which nations will win medals and, of course, what new doping scandals may come to light. But performance-enhancing substances are nothing new. They've been part of sports since ancient times. Daniel M. Rosen is author of Dope, A History of Performance Enhancement in Sports from the 19th Century to Today. Dan, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, I know your book starts with the 19th century, but I'm guessing as long as there was sports, there was cheating, and as long as there were herbs, there were people figuring out ways to at least try to enhance their performance. Is that true? How far back does it go?
Well, there are stories that suggest it goes back to the original Olympics in ancient Greece. And, you know, they're just stories. There's no, like, record or diary of an athlete that says, I ate this or I took that, and it made me stronger or faster. But one of the legends is that some of the athletes who needed additional strength in their pursuits would eat a delicacy we know today as Rocky Mountain oysters.
I see.
and in that way, they would boost their levels of testosterone. And what's interesting about that is, assuming the story is true, that that little bit of folk wisdom or whatever is amazingly close to what was developed a couple of millennia later.
Oh, wow. So tell us about that.
So, you know, Rocky Mountain oysters are what you might think they are.
That's right. They come from bulls.
That's right. They do.
And the problem for the Greek athletes, by the way, was they became distracted when they ran past pastures, I think. I'm sorry.
Possibly. Yeah. And so the original testosterone that was isolated from the same kinds of things in the 19th century and early 20th century. And so by consuming that delicacy, they were probably getting a little bit of testosterone. And what happened in the early part of the 20th century is that the hormone was actually isolated, and then they figured out how to synthesize it. And then in about the 1950s, the Soviet Olympic team started using it for their athletes who were doing weightlifting and some other sports like discus. And some conversations between the trainers for the Soviet team and an American trainer led the American trainer to start using it here in weightlifting and bodybuilding. And that's how steroids really got into sports in the United States.
And, of course, it was legal at the time. That's why they could have that conversation. And lots of conversations around, especially women using those drugs at that time and talking about the advantage that would give them if they chose to use substances.
Right. Well, if you think about the East German women's swim team in, I think it was 1976, where their body types looked suspiciously masculine and some of them had deeper voices, the East Germans had a very, very highly developed program, and so did the Soviets, in terms of doping, and they were having their female athletes and their male athletes using steroids.
Now, your book goes back to the 19th century, and you talked about the development of synthetic testosterone. What else was happening back then?
Well, for instance, the amphetamines were developed in the 19th century. Originally, they were given to racehorses. A number of doping techniques started in horse racing. And some wise guy eventually figured, hey, if it works for the racehorses, let's try it on people too. But they were experimenting with a number of things back in the 19th century that would sound barbaric today. For instance, at the beginning of the 20th century in the 1904 Olympics in St. Louis, a runner named Thomas Hicks won the marathon, and he did it while consuming a potion that included strychnine and cognac.
Hmm.
And, you know, we think of strychnine as rat poison, which it is. It's also a bit of a stimulant, or more than a bit of a stimulant, but, you know, as it kills rats, if you take too much of it in humans, it'll kill you too. And Thomas Hicks, between the potion that he was using and the unbearable heat in St. Louis in the 1904 Olympics, almost crawled across the finish line of that marathon and was rather incapacitated for some time after that, you know, and had a hard time getting home from the race.
You didn't tell me how did he do? I mean, I know
he won.
So he was the winner. You did say that. So so now does it catch on? I mean, when I'm wondering when it becomes a problem for people and when they decide. First of all, when it is widely known that there are these substances that can work, and then when does it become a problem?
Well, that's a good question. And so amphetamines, I think, were beginning to be used in professional sports in probably around the 20s or 30s. You know, for instance, baseball players playing a doubleheader that goes into the evening or something need to keep their energy up, and so amphetamines would do that for you. And when it became a problem, I think it was probably around the 1950s when the Cold War was pretty much at its height, and you have the Eastern Bloc nations trying to find any way possible to, you know, get athletic glory. And then you have the Western nations having to play catch-up. So, you know, you have instances like in the 1960 Olympics, a cyclist died from a combination of heat distress and the use of amphetamines during the team time trial. He just basically collapsed and died in the heat in Rome. So.
But there's still no official or international movement at that point, even though there's a lot of discussion about it, even though...
And it's actually that athlete's death that began the discussion about, hey, maybe we should consider banning these drugs. And by 1968, the first rules banning various drugs were in place. Some they could test for fairly easily because the test for amphetamines was pretty good already by then. I think they had already banned steroids, but the actual testing for steroids took another 8 or 10 years before it was really proved out. So, you know, people were still able to use the steroids in the 68 and 72 Olympics without getting caught.
Well, today we think we have a pretty sophisticated way of detecting, monitoring, and policing. And I want to bring in Dorianne Lombele-Coleman to our conversation right now. She's a professor of law at Duke. And she worked on developing domestic and international anti-doping programs and has litigated some of the earliest doping cases. Welcome back to the show, Dorianne.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about, let's talk about the World Anti-Doping Agency and its origins.
So WADA is the culmination of a movement among countries, national team sponsors, and some Olympic federations and athletes to harmonize anti-doping rules and programs around the world. It has its genesis probably in all of the history that Dan just recounted, but really gets impetus in the period after 1988 and the Ben Johnson scandal at the Seoul Olympics, and gathers force in the period between 1988 and 1989, when there are a series of doping scandals that reveal to the public and thus to sponsors and parents of children who aspire to be Olympic athletes and professional athletes, that that there is this underbelly in sport that's quite significant. And so in the 1999 period, we get the real formalization of the organization that is the World Anti-Doping Agency.
So tell us about the list of banned substances. It's updated every year. What are the criteria? How do you get on that list?
So formally, the criteria are embedded in the code, the WADA code, and all of the substances and methods on the banned substances and methods list have to be performance enhancing, or the science has to support their being performance enhancing. And they either have to also be bad for your health or against the spirit of sport. And so in order for a substance or method to be on the banned list, it has to fulfill two of the three criteria. It might also fulfill all three of the criteria.
All right. And this is, again, reviewed every year.
It is, including for the scientific validity of the judgment that it's performance enhancing.
So if, for instance, you believe that Rocky Mountain oysters or any other substance might be enhancing, might work, if it isn't proved to be viable, it wouldn't make the list.
It shouldn't make the list. And so substances are added because there is some scientific evidence that it is performance enhancing, and then taken off, for example, when further evidence confirms that it's not.
I mean, it's an interesting question, because if you had something that might be dangerous, rat poison, and the word gets out that the guy won, the guy won the marathon in 1892, took rat poison, people start taking it, but if it doesn't, it wouldn't be on the list because it doesn't work.
Correct, because it's a list of prohibited doping substances, and doping has a connotation that isn't just about health.
All right, so let's talk, because I think you mentioned Ben Johnson, of course, a well-reported case, and I think Lance Armstrong, that case was probably even more widely known, and perhaps pivotal in our understanding now of doping and how we treat it. Remind us of the Lance Armstrong case and its impact on this. Lance Armstrong.
Would you like me to talk about it, or Dan? I understand has a lot more experience with the Armstrong case.
Do talk about that, Lance Armstrong, because that I think plays an important role in the history and the trajectory of how we have come to police doping.
Well, I would say that's a fair assessment. So Lance Armstrong was a promising young American cyclist in the early 90s. And started racing professionally after the 92 Olympics. And a few years later, he became sick with testicular cancer. And in 1998, he came back to the sport after having been successfully treated. And he started in 1999 through 2005. He won seven consecutive Tours de France. And he did it in part, but as your previous guest mentioned, in the first segment, he had the best doctors and the best team and the best, scientists helping him. He had a doctor named Michaela Ferrari. He's an Italian sports medicine doctor who helped him design a program that would very, very well skirt the rules. So when tests for EPO, erythropoietin, which is a natural hormone, but there's also an artificial version that causes you to make additional red blood cells. So when that test was available, Dr. Ferrari helped Armstrong and some of his other clients pioneer a technique called microdoping, where they still used it, but they used it in quantities that would get out of your system quickly, so you would beat the drug test. And he used other techniques as well, other compounds. But he was able to evade discovery pretty much his whole career. There were rumors about it. And Greg Armstrong in the early 2000s said, you know, Lance Armstrong is either the greatest comeback story in sports or the biggest fraud. And that caused a lot of bad blood between Lance and Greg. And it turned out that Greg was right on the second point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so
go ahead.
Flashing forward to 2012, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency was investigating another cyclist, and that cyclist's trail led back to some of the same people who were involved with Lance Armstrong indirectly. And when they started interviewing some of those people, all of the pieces started falling into place, and they were able to put together, for lack of a better term, a dossier that detailed pretty precisely what Armstrong and his team did. And on the basis of that, Armstrong lost all of his tour titles, and he is now banned permanently from all sports.
Well, Dorianne, that leads to the question, though, because you've helped develop some anti-doping programs. You know, how easy is it to mask this stuff if it enhances your performance or your general development, and you can get it out of your system before the contest? Can we really know how much this is going on?
One of the mantras in the anti-doping effort is always that the athletes and their chemists are a step ahead of the anti-doping authorities. And so, by definition, the prohibited substances list is mostly constructed out of information about what athletes are doing, although as the organization becomes more sophisticated, they get some ex-ante or advance notice of chemicals and drugs and their effects and things the athletes might do. And so initially, athletes can use substances that end up on the prohibited substances list without them being on this list and so get away with or mask enhancing substances in that context. But also there are masking agents, of course, and I believe in the first segment you discussed masking agents a bit. And again, in that respect, the athletes are often ahead of the testers, and so we learn about masking agents over time. And as the Lance Armstrong case illustrates, that's a process.
We're taking a look at doping and Olympic athletes today on The State of Things. Talking to Dorianne Lambele-Coleman, a professor of law at Duke University, and Daniel M. Rosen, author of Dope, A History of Performance Enhancement in Sports from the 19th Century. And also, I would think that chemists, you know, are pretty shrewd at figuring out, taking a look at the test and then creating an agent that's going to evade the test and still be effective.
Correct. It's an ongoing iteration that is, you know, a dance. It's not a pretty dance, but it's a dance among athletes and their teams and the authorities.
As this, Daniel, as this conversation about doping has gone on over the past 100 years or so, what has been the public sense of the responsibility of the chemists and the coaches and the doctors, all these people around the athletes who are enabling them to do this? Where have people thought the responsibility should lie, and has that changed over time?
Well, I'd say it's definitely changed over time. Call me a bit of a cynic, but when I was growing up in the 60s and early 70s, we looked at professional athletes, my friends and I, and we thought, well, you know, if they take drugs to do their job, it's because they're expected to get results and the drugs help them get results, and no big deal. That's what a professional does. And over the past 50 years or so, the attitude has really changed. Nowadays, we look down on athletes who are caught doping, and a lot of competitive athletes look down on the athletes that are doping, too. In terms of the attitude, I think it's gone, you know, kind of a 180 from being accepted as something people do in order to perform better to being kind of a scourge. And the chemists and the coaches and the trainers who are involved in that, I think now would be thought of in a negative light, whereas maybe 50 or 100 years ago, they would have been thought of more positively.
Well, take a look, Dorianne, at the most recent scandal, the Russian, state-sponsored doping scandal. IOC says the Russians will be out of the games. Now, there have been some exceptions on appeal. What's the ultimate message in that, do you think? And based on, you know, sort of a little bit of what Daniel has said, public opinion, the sports industry itself, are we taking this more seriously? And will athletes who look at what happened with the Russian Olympics, the team, what message should they take away from that? Is that a nod and a wink because you can get away with it if you appeal to the court? Or did what the IOC say tell you, you know, you better not play with this, you could lose your career? How do you think athletes are perceiving the current moment and how seriously we're taking it?
So the current moment is really complicated because the athletes, especially the athletes today in Pyeongchang, are getting mixed messages from the Olympic movement. The Olympic movement is fighting institutions within the Olympic movement are fighting amongst themselves on the question of Russian participation in the games or Russian athletes' participation in the games. And with WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, and the IOC taking the position that athletes who have been tainted by doping cannot compete in the games starting tomorrow in a day and a half for us, but tomorrow in Pyeongchang, and the Court of Arbitration for Sport taking the position that that it's going to process the cases according to standard due process procedures, including standard evidentiary procedures, and without regard to sort of the PR message that they may send by clearing athletes previously banned of doping to compete in the Olympic Games. And so currently the athletes are getting a really tough message.
All right. Well, we will see how it plays out. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Dorianne Lambele-Coleman is a professor of law at Duke. She worked on developing domestic and international anti-doping programs and litigated some of the initial cases. Dorianne, thank you again for coming.
Glad to be here.
Daniel M. Rosen, the author of Dope, A History of Performance Enhancement in Sports from the 19th Century to Today. Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can find out more about their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, does Black History Month have a long-term impact on education? We'll talk about it with the co-host of the web show, Intelligently Ratchet, on The State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned.